My name's John Kirk, and I'm talking to Mr. Orville Forbes on December 3rd, Thursday, 1992, and we're in Conway, Arkansas, at Mr. Forbes' home.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with UALR history professor Dr. John Kirk about Arkansas Governor Orville Forbes.
See, I didn't please the segregationists. I wasn't strong enough to please them. But they couldn't argue with what had happened.
Kirk's book, Redefining the Color Line, Black Activism in Little Rock, 1940 to 1970, takes up the history of civil rights in Arkansas.
Yeah, well, the underlying basis for the book is that I wanted to tell the larger story of the history of the civil rights movement in the state.
Redefining civil rights in Little Rock, with historian John Kirk, talking about Governor Orville Forbes on Arts and Letters.
The time has come when all the colorful phrases, clever slogans, and smooth campaign techniques must give way to plain, straight talk. Because the future of Arkansas is at a crossroads. And can we really afford the luxury of experimenting with unseasoned leadership in the hands of inexperienced candidates? Or will we elect a man with proven ability and workable solutions? The man you elect as governor of Arkansas must be capable of sound thinking and judgment. Better still, he must be able to think and act simultaneously, drawing upon his experience as a source of information. Orville Forbes has solutions, and solutions are the only true measure of progress.
Mr. Forbes, you grew up in northwest Arkansas, in a county where there's not a great big black population. In fact, no, hardly any black population at all. When was the first time you encountered a black person? Can you remember?
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
Yes, I can't remember the precise date, but when I was still a youngster, the black workmen used to come in on the train, and they had cars, living quarters in cars on the train. And these were what were called tie loading crews. By tie, I mean the railroad cross ties that goes under the rails.
Yeah. Today, we'll be redefining the color line as we talk with historian John Kirk about the life of Governor Orville Forbes.
It's kind of odd when you know, somebody who is famous in history, seeing them and actually meeting them and shaking their hand is quite an extraordinary thing. And it's an odd thing because it's very commonplace. They're just there in their house slippers answering the door as someone who you've seen in these kind of fraught circumstances. So it's a disarming set of circumstances. But, you know, I'd read about Forbes and knew more about his life story and knew that he was a more complicated figure than the kind of villain figure he plays during the school crisis.
You back down, could I lion, I say. And your heart, yeah, your heart shall prevail. And your heart, yeah, your heart shall prevail.
In this candid oral history, Kirk, then a young graduate student, talks with the former governor and probes him about the veracity of his decisions about the Central High Crisis of 1957.
One of the turning points of the 57 school thing was when, you call that, the National Guard surrounded the school and all that kind of thing happened. I mean, you said you had there was a choice at the time, you could go one way or the other.
These rare tapes take us inside the mind of an older man attempting to wrestle with his past. And during this episode, we'll hear Kirk's remembrances on that original interview from 1992. What do you think he made of you, a 22-year-old kid from England?
Yeah, with a British accent, right, as well on top of it, which makes a difference too. I think, people are... Throughout my interviews, people were curious about me as much as I was curious about them, I think, and wondered why a young person from England was interested in Arkansas and interested in the civil rights movement in the state. So there's a interest in disarming piece of curiosity when you go in that situation. I think that helped very much to have the youth on my side, to have this English accent, to have this outsider's perspective. Helped a lot in the interviews, and I think helped people open up to me in ways that they may have not opened up to other people.
That's historian John Kirk and Governor Orville Faubus on Arts and Letters. John Kirk, professor, historian.
Welcome.
Hi, Brad.
These tapes were fascinating with Governor Orville Faubus. Could you set the stage for us a little bit? You're 22 years old.
That's right. Yeah, I was staying in Little Rock between the summer of 1992 and the summer of 1993. And driving around for my PhD thesis, interviewing people all across the state. And Faubus was actually one of the first interviewees who I spoke with.
So you had just come over. You were staying in Little Rock.
I was staying in Little Rock, yeah. And, you know, I just learned to drive. I'd never driven back in the United Kingdom. So I just learned to drive to be able to do the interviews, bought my first car and went up there. And this was one of my first trips outside of Little Rock to Conway. So it was an interesting driving experience.
Yes. Tell us about what happened with the car.
Yeah, well, my tire blew out on the way up there. And I flopped into Faubus's driveway with this flat tire. And one of the first things I said to him was, you know, I've got a flat tire. I have no idea what to do. I have no idea to fix it. And he said, oh, that'll be okay. Come in and I'll get it fixed. So he called the garage up for me in Conway. And they said, oh, yeah, we'll be around there in a week or two. And so Faubus kind of stiffened his back up and said, this is Orville Faubus. I need somebody here right now. And within 20 minutes, there was a little man under the car jacking up and changing my tires over. So I got a firsthand experience of that, you know, still many years after being in office, he still had some pull in Arkansas.
Yeah, and just as an aside, at the time he was how old?
This was not very long, just several years before he passed away. So I think he passed away in 97, something like that. So he was getting on all the time.
So what main storylines were you trying to capture? I noticed early on you tried to discuss his relationships as a kid to the African-American population where he grew up.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, a lot of my work is based on writing the longer history of the civil rights movement in the state beyond the school crisis. So obviously I was there to talk to him about the events of September 1957 and the things that he's famous for. But I also wanted to get a much longer perspective on his life and question him about what he'd been doing before then, what he did after, and to put the events of that school crisis in a much longer perspective.
So he relates his relationship to the black community early on as that he hadn't spent a lot of time with African-American people.
That's right, yeah. I mean, he grew up in northern Arkansas, of course, where there's a very small historically black population. Most of the black population in Arkansas has always been in that Delta area with that legacy of cotton farming, which, of course, didn't exist in the north. So Faubus hadn't grown up in a large black community, although he did relate that he had experiences seeing African-Americans primarily through the railroads. And the railroads came through there, and African-Americans would go through there. And he remembered growing up and seeing African-Americans playing baseball and at recreation and leisure. So he had some experience. He'd seen black people before, and he'd related to black people. But no, he didn't grow up in a place where there's a very large black community at all.
Then, while I was still a young man, every settlement had an independent baseball team. Mm-hmm. And they would invite the black teams to come in and play them there at Combs and St. Paul and the settlements along the railroad. And they'd set a big dinner on the ground for them, what we call dinner on the ground, you know, we used to have at the picnics and the memorial services. One of the greatest feasts you could have, you know, mm-hmm. Where the women prepared the food at home and brought all kinds of it, including pies and cakes and cookies and all this sort of thing. So I saw black people then. They'd come in to play. They had an all-black team. And they would, the women would set the dinner out, you know, and just turn them in and they'd eat as long as they wanted to and all they wanted. And then they'd have the baseball game afterward. So that's the first blacks that I saw.
So what was the first campaign he had?
Forbes came up in the Sid McMath administration, which was a very liberal administration. Sid McMath led a so-called GI revolt, returning soldiers from the Second World War, who looked to reform, looked to repeal the poll tax, looked for fairly progressive changes, which didn't really directly address race at the time, but understood that addressing race relations would be an important part of reforming Southern politics and reforming the Southern economy.
You talked specifically about the black community in Little Rock when you came governor there. What were the first contacts you had with the black community in Little Rock?
Well, when I was in Sid McMath's administration, which was 1949 to 1952, I served about 14 months on the Arkansas Highway Commission. And the commission as a body, and there were 12 members of the commission then, designating the roads that were to be improved. I mean, we'd have to establish the program for the highway director and the employees that did the actual work.
What job did he do in the McMath administration?
I think he was involved in that highways in some capacity or other. And, you know, that was one of the big scandals in the McMath administration. One of the reasons why he ended up losing the election was scandals over the state highway system. So that would have put Forbes in the middle of political controversy early on in his career.
I was the less affluent member of the commission.
Mm-hmm.
So I finally told Governor McMath, I said, I need, if I'm to keep on working almost full-time for the administration, I can't do it without pay. I need a paying job, one with a salary.
Yeah.
See, I travel all roads in my district, sometimes at my own expense in my own car, to go and see the roads and inspect them and to pick out the ones of greatest need and then program it. And there were so many, we could hardly make a dent in the problem. So a vacancy occurred in Governor McMath's office, and I got the job as an administrative assistant. And then there were only two of us assisting the governor. There was the executive secretary, which was Henry Woods, who's a federal judge now, and myself as administrative assistant. So I did a lot of the correspondence, and they turned over to me nearly all of the black people who had problems.
Mm-hmm.
When they came in, they were directed to me, and I talked with them about whatever problem they had and what they wanted, and got acquainted with quite a number of them that way.
So Forbes came into politics with a fairly liberal outlook, and of course his father was a socialist in the Ozark Mountains, and Forbes' middle name, Orville Eugene Forbes, he was named after America's prime socialist leader, Eugene Debs. So he had this heritage of left-leaning politics and was a moderate when he came into politics. Of course, also the famous story is that he attended Commonwealth College in MENA, which was, you know, a communist training school. And of course, later he said when he was on the campaign trail, oh, I didn't really know what was going on, and I left after a few weeks. So he had quite a liberal-leaning background. So, he's a very complicated figure, not your kind of common garden segregationist. He had much more complicated politics than the snapshot of the 1957 school crisis really gives him credit for.
Easy now, Rasta. There are many imposters trying to find a way, lurking. For ways to bring you down, searching. They care not about the warrior within, for we pose a threat to the establishment.
Orville Forbes is only one man, and you have only one vote. Together, they'll put your voice in government and Arkansas back on the road to progress. Elect Orville Forbes, governor.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with Dr. John Kirk about Governor Orville Forbes. We'll be back in a moment.
Maybe then we'll stop dying in these streets.
Clausewitz once said that war is a continuation of politics by other means. And in this country of ours, we have devised a system whereby we settle our differences without a test of strength of arms, where people are killed, captured, and imprisoned. We use the ballot box here, and once the determination has been made, it is accepted by the people. And even the losers can go ahead and live in good conscience and without fear. For as I've said many times, in the field of politics, those who lose make their contribution to the success of our system the same as those who win.
I'm J. Bradley Menick, and this is Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Dr. John Kirk as he talks about the life of Governor Orville Favas.
Well, the leaves on the trees and the cold on the window help to remind me that I got to go slow.
We can go back earlier than those years. Simak Math was probably one of the first people, or knowledge, one of the first people who courted the black vote to get appointed as governor. Did you follow that lead? Did you canvass the black vote for appointment too?
Yeah.
You did.
Well,
how did you go about that within the city of Little Rock, say? How would you go about canvassing the black vote for elections?
I went to see the leaders of the organizations. One was I.S. McClinton.
So he talked a little bit about I.S. McClinton.
That's right. And I.S. McClinton was head of the Arkansas Democratic Voters Association, which is a black organization representing black Democrats. And figures like I.S. McClinton and others would be influential in courting the black vote. And white leaders would look to cultivate those black leaders who they thought could influence big blocks of the black vote and get them on their side. And then they would, in return, for favors, hopefully deliver them the black voted election. So it worked through a kind of captain system, if you like, that he would cultivate key figures and that those figures would deliver their constituencies over to that candidate for the vote.
And I visited with them and asked for their support.
How did you do that? Did you call them in? Did you go out to see them?
I went to I.S. McClinton's home, sat down in his home, which was not completely customary at the time. And I met with Bishop Sherman there. And then I would see them at my headquarters, mm-hmm, or wherever they wanted to meet with me.
Let us forget this world around until the time starts staying still. And we try so hard to understand this world where there ain't no understanding.
Now, the Supreme Court decision of May 17, 1954 had been handed down before I was nominated and before I was elected. Mm-hmm. So there had begun to be some concern about that among the people in the state that became known as segregationists.
Yeah.
So there was some opposition and some difficulty there. Mm-hmm. But I handled it in a manner where there was no real controversy and no real difficulty.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court decision in 1954. Mm-hmm. So what was his take on the reverse of
Plessy versus Ferguson?
Yes, Plessy versus Ferguson.
Right. So the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education school desegregation comes down and says that schools have to desegregate. And there's a backlash in the South, so-called massive resistance to that. But Favas, initially at least, is fairly moderate on that. And incoming as governor, he's asked what his position is. And he says, well, it's up to a local level. Different districts will approach this in a different kind of way, and they should be left to do their own thing. The state shouldn't intervene. And of course, in Arkansas, some districts did voluntarily desegregate. Fayetteville, Charleston were among the first in the South to desegregate, which they did so voluntarily for a variety of reasons. And so he was, you know, very cagey about it and didn't have any sort of real hard line on how school desegregation would proceed during his administration.
And we're try so hard to understand this world when there ain't no understanding. Well, what's the use in time? I see all the things that I've seen in this life have helped me to be who I am.
How did Orville Favas court the black vote during his campaign for governor against Governor Cherry?
quietly, as did many white politicians at the time. You know, the black vote was continuing to grow. It wasn't a huge vote at the time because there were still many disfranchisement measures in place. But it was a significant vote, and it was one that most white politicians, at least, wanted to try and court. And Forbes understood that it would be important to do that. So he did it behind the back channels. He wouldn't do it openly. He wouldn't openly solicit the black vote, but he would go into black communities. He would contact black leaders, and he would have a network of people in the black community who could try and help deliver the vote for him.
What about other leaders in the black community? Who else would you go to?
Oh, I have numbers of them. They began to come to see me, you know, and nearly all of them had some kind of organization. Sometimes it's just on paper.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was genuine. Mm-hmm. But I met with them and conversed with all of them and listened to their efforts to voice their sentiments. I wanted to understand them and to understand because I had never dealt with large numbers of black people before I was in the Mac administration.
Mm-hmm. How could you tell who were genuine black leaders and who weren't? How could you tell who gave you support and who wouldn't in return
It's just kind of a sensing.
Yeah.
And based on the information that you gather.
Mm-hmm. How about somebody like Jeffrey Hawkins, the East End Civic League? Do you deal with them?
Jeffrey Hawkins is one of the best, most respected, and most honest among all of the black leaders.
Mm-hmm. He particularly talked about Jeffrey Hawkins and his respect for him.
That's right. And Hawkins was another one of those captains in the community. Hawkins was in the East End of Little Rock and had formed the East End Civic League just after the Second World War. Again, a group of mainly African-American former veterans who wanted to have a more representative voice for African-Americans in the community. And of course, at the time, legitimate channels of representation weren't really open to the black community. There were barriers to voting. There were barriers to becoming elected in the party. So a lot of those black leaders worked through whites who they knew in the Democratic Party as a kind of brokering of influence. So exchanging promises of black votes for promises of things that white politicians would do for them once elected. So they were kind of, in some ways, the middlemen between white politicians and the black community, brokering and negotiating advances in exchange for votes.
Let me tell you a story. Drinking wine, speaking time, trying to find a way for every day to be good. Certainly know that we should. Certainly know that we could, yeah, yeah. I pray for spring and summer. Call myself hoping for the fall.
Are there any names that I've missed that you can think of, or other people you dealt with in the black community?
Well, I dealt with L.C. Bates and Mrs. Daisy Bates. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a great controversy with. She was cast on one side and I was cast on the other in a controversy. But we were never enemies personally. Mm-hmm. Always on a friendly basis. Mm. In spite of what you might, the impression you might gain from reading some of the news stories.
Mm-hmm. So what was his relationship with Daisy Bates and the NAACP?
Again, you know, it's quite surprising. We demonized Forbes in the 57 school crisis, and, you know, rightly so in many ways. He did, after a while, accept this mantle of segregationist and kind of reveled in it and created a huge amount of political success from it, winning unprecedented consecutive terms as governor from it. So, you know, he did revel in it in the end, and there's a lot to be said about that. But throughout it, which is kind of fascinating, he always maintained contacts with the black community and always had some kind of friendly relationships with the black community. With L.C. and Daisy Bates, of course, the school crisis and school desegregation put them on very opposite sides. And it was difficult at that time because Daisy Bates became public enemy number one. Forbes was on the other side defending white supremacy. It became very difficult and those relationships became very strained. But at the same time, you know, he would still have inroads to the Bateses. He still cultivated a relationship with them.
In fact, L.C. Bates, when he succeeded his wife, Daisy, as head of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People in Arkansas, he was one of my advisors.
So he always tried to keep the black community close. And of course, taking a stand for white supremacy made that quite difficult. But for many African-Americans, there weren't really many alternatives. There weren't many direct routes into power. They still had to work through white politicians to get things done.
I don't know, I can't speak for each and every individual in the state of Arkansas, but so far as myself, speaking as the people's representative at this particular time, I have the greatest respect for you who engage in this field of politics and in this business of lawmaking, for you are truly under our system, the representatives of the people.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking with Dr. John Kirk about Governor Orville Faubus. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Focus on the Newsmakers from KAAY 1090, Little Rock, Arkansas.
November 8th is a date that needs little comment, but what are the feelings of a man who has stepped from the limelight for the first year in many? Focus speaks with Governor Orville Faubus about his plans for Election Day.
Well, I think we'll go home Sunday, and I'll be there attending a few personal affairs Monday, and we'll vote Tuesday morning and probably drive back to Little Rock that afternoon. That's the way we've usually spent the day, and those are our plans.
I'm Jay Bradley Menick, and this is Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Dr. John Kirk as he talks about the life of Governor Orville Faubus.
So black politicians were also aware of that they had to try and keep some sort of relationship with the white power structure. So it's a kind of odd and complicated dynamic, but certainly not as polarizing as you might imagine from the headlines and events of September 1957.
Well, I dreamed I was free from this place. Yes, I dreamed I was free from this place.
The big mistake that was made was that the federal government started listening to the militants instead of the reasonable, logical people. Mm-hmm. Those blacks, you know, were termed Uncle Toms and Aunt Marthas, and they were kicked back in the corner just like us white folks were. Mm-hmm. By them. So that is what caused the situation to become more difficult.
What evil have I done to be here now? What evil have I done to be here now?
If the federal government had had an attitude of dealing with the honest, responsible black people, and now some of these that were extreme were also honest, but they were extremists. Mm-hmm. No compromise.
Who were the extremists? Who were moderates amongst the black community in your perception?
That's too difficult to analyze now.
It is. Mm-hmm. But if you point towards extremist elements among the black community, you mean the NAACP or?
Well, the worst ones were the white people who were encouraging the blacks. I learned long before I became governor that the main objective of the communist organization was to foment discord and strife to weaken the democratic form of government. So you had those encouraging the blacks, and the black people sometimes not able to discern what the motives were. Here's somebody at their shoulder to help them, you know. Mm-hmm. Followed their lead. Mm-hmm. And of course you had some black extremists too, but they weren't as bad as the white extremists. Mm-hmm. They just got hipped, these people did. And being communists too, they were glad to create the strife and the turmoil. But to them, race mixing would solve all the problems of the earth.
Carry this burden
Now, it real soft some, but you better let the mixing come about through the natural development in human relations between the people. You don't make people like each other. You can't compel them. The more you try to compel, the worse the situation becomes.
Yeah, out away with no ball and no chain.
I'm Jay Bradley Medic, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Dr. John Kirk as he talks with Governor Orville Faubus about the 1957 Central High Crisis.
I'm gonna claim love or his name.
At the time of the 57 school thing, a lot of things had already begun to change in Little Rock. A lot of desegregation in some aspects had already taken place. The buses had changed the year before. The buses had desegregated in 56. And a few of the signs had already come down, the water fountains, kind of indiscreetly. Why were the schools the sticking point if that progress had already been made?
Well, in the state as a whole, we already had more public school desegregation than 11 other states combined that had a comparable problem.
I'm gonna claim love for his name, oh name.
So there had been progress, so far as the Supreme Court's decision is concerned, progress with all deliberate speed. If anyone with the problem had attained that nebulous phrase of deliberate speed, then Arkansas had.
When my trials are so heavy burdened, I just give all to heaven and claim his name.
Now, why the big commotion then at Little Rock? Man that I knew very well, we'd been friends for a long, long time. He's from Northwest Arkansas, and so was I. And that's Virgil Blossom, superintendent of schools in Little Rock. One of the biggest school jobs in the state.
What was his relationship to the superintendent of the Little Rock School District?
I think it got more and more strained over time. And, you know, most people in Little Rock had wanted to leave school desegregation to Virgil Blossom, who was the superintendent of schools. He'd stepped to the forefront. He drew up his own plan of minimum compliance with Brown that allowed for token desegregation. And much of the community had been happy just to let him get on with it and implement this plan so they wouldn't have to deal with it. And Blossom took this on his shoulders, but the plan unraveled as the date came near. And Faubus, in particular, felt that Blossom, since his plan was coming to pieces, was looking to dump everything on the governor's lap and make him be the person who desegregated the schools. And Faubus, for political reasons, didn't want to be seen as the guy who desegregated the schools. So he wanted Blossom to be seen and Blossom's plan to be there. You know, they did it and there's nothing I could do about it. That's the law. But then when Blossom throws it over to Faubus and says, we need your help, we need you to make this plan work, we need your protection, then he starts to back away pretty quickly.
He was being pushed by the extremist on the integration side, who, as I said before, expected race mixing by compulsion, and that it solved all the social problems of the area. Virgil was in a matter of speaking, in their hands. So they decided they would integrate Central High School because I was with Mrs. Bates. She had applied a number, but looked like the best prospect.
I'm gonna claim love or his name.
All right, you got your liberal left-wing press nationwide who's following this line that integration, race mixing,
is the wave of the future, the order of the day, the morally right thing. Everything else is wrong. This will solve all the problems. Mm-hmm. So they worked out a plan. And because of the publicity you could get at that time, Virgil Bossom expected to become an overnight celebrity. Mm-hmm. Now this appeals to people. And those who were backing him up had the same idea.
I'm gonna claim, love for his name,
oh name,
when my trials are so heavy burdened, I just give all to heaven and claim his name.
So he spoke meeting after meeting in the Little Rock School District explaining, but they never would answer specifically a lot of the problems. How many? And just where? They always avoided. Then they built a new high school called Hall High School. There, the what I call the hoi polloi, mm-hmm. the well-to-do, could send their children to a still segregated school, while ordinary working people who couldn't just pick up and move, mm-hmm. who are bound by economic circumstances, they're the ones that would have to bear the burden, if it was a burden, of the new race mix in the schools. And that was Central High School. This created, behind the scenes, a great deal of resentment. Yeah. Sometimes groups of ministers come in and talk to me, you know, and they were all imbued with not being classified as racist or anything like that, and they wanted to be approved by the press. Talk to me about trying to change my attitude in handling it in some way, and I say, is your church integrated? Oh, no, Governor, we can't do that. Well, for God's sake, if a church, a religious organization of supposedly people who are doing their best to do right and are doing right, if they can't sit down together peaceably in a church and worship the Creator, and then put the burden on the children who didn't have any choice, or the poor people who couldn't move away like the rich could move away, or they send their kids to private schools, that created a lot of resentment.
I'm gonna claim love for his name.
Central High School was going to be a great example. Here's this plan that's been worked out. Going to solve a problem that hadn't been solved in the history of mankind satisfactorily, without difficulty. So the segregationists then, who hadn't been too much alarmed, now before that I told them, now if this high school, this district decides that they want to integrate now, that's their problem. You people stay out of there, your agitation. Yeah, you've got a right to preach what you believe and you have meetings, but don't go in there and stir trouble up in that school district. If that school district, the board decides that they won't have integration, that's up to them and the patrons of that district. So I stopped them from going in a lot of places and creating a lot of discord. So then along comes this group. Say Central High School is going to be the great example for all the rest of the state and the rest of the nation. So the segregationists, the ones who didn't believe in the race mixing, got alarmed. And they started having meetings. And I mean, they had some mass meetings that were big. And Jim Johnson, the man who ran against me for second term, as a segregation leader,
people would fight to get up there with money in their fist to give to him, you know, to in this effort to thwart what the integrationists were planning. That's going to set an example for everybody else. So they said, if this is going to be an example, we better get interested. And that was the reason for the mass meetings beginning all over Arkansas. Prominent people addressed them, a big organization. Resolutions and civic clubs even directed to me. Then when they said it's going to be an example for the whole nation, they started inviting in the outstate, Texas people, Mississippi, Governor Griffin of Georgia. And they had mass meetings and had them as speakers. And so when a man like Griffin of Georgia would come in and say, we don't have any integration in the state of Georgia, I'll tell you why. The governor's not for it, the legislature's not for it, and the school boards are not for it. All you need is a school board that says no, and a legislature that says no, and a governor that says no. So that put me right in front of the gun.
Okay, so he takes us into kind of a behind-the-scenes look in 1957. Mm-hmm. And we had talked a little bit earlier, but the first thing was that he thought that the Supreme Court decision was not a correct one. That's at least what he said. Mm-hmm. Then he also felt that his goal primarily was to make sure that people were not hurt. Mm-hmm. And you ask a wonderful question about, well, why didn't you bring in the National Guard to escort the children into school?
One of the turning points of the 57 school thing was when, you call that the National Guard surrounded the school and all that kind of thing happened. I mean, you said you had there was a choice at the time, you know, you could go one way or the other. Couldn't you have instructed the guard to say, keep order and let the black children in, rather than saying keep order and keep the black children out?
What did you take from that conversation? He said that if he had gone the other way, that a lot of people would have been hurt, and he was pretty sure of it.
Yeah. But he also chuckled, I remember distinctly, and said, well, you know, if I'd have done that, I would have never been reelected again.
With the emotions as high as they were, and a sentiment 85% the other way, I'd just as well have resigned right then.
Which signifies to me that he understood that he was making a political decision that was based on a calculation that if he had sided with Little Rock Nine and if he decided with desegregation, he would have been kicked out of office.
I would have been impeached as soon as the legislature met.
And he was quite right, too. He would have been, and that was the case right across the South. You could not afford to be seen to have any pro-desegregation leanings at the time.
So it was a political
political implications. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that it was so strong at the time. Mm-hmm. I had observed long before that when you please people, they forget it much sooner than when you displease them. And in a situation like that, I had to displease some people. I displeased some powerful people. Mm-hmm. I never got one favorable line. I don't reckon in the Arkansas Gazette after that, a statewide newspaper, or the largest in the state. Mm-hmm. Jen, you have it? All right.
But you could have gone either way. You could have told the soldiers to let the black children in or keep them out, but the main decision was...
Yeah, we could have kept order.
There was disorder when the black children were kept out as well, because they were hanging around amongst the crowds of segregationists, weren't they?
There wasn't a hand laid on one.
Mm-hmm.
There was not a hand laid on one when they came.
Mm-hmm. So therefore, maybe there wouldn't have been any trouble if they'd have been let through.
Oh.
I'm just playing devil's advocate for you.
Anyone who thinks that doesn't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
When my trials are so heavy burden, I just give all to heaven and claim His name.
It was was interesting, though, because he said that many other people were the ones who wanted to be nationally famous. And he blamed outsiders coming in, too, to stir up a lot of trouble.
That's right. You know, and there's all kinds of myths about the school desegregation at Central High that still swirl around today. And there's research being done that shows many of the mob at Central High were actually from right here in Little Rock and right here in Arkansas. And, you know, people have gone and checked the license plates from the photographs and all that kind of thing and identified people in the mob. So there are a lot of myths about all this was done by outside people. It had nothing to do with people in Little Rock. And these myths are generated as a way of deflecting blame and attributing blame to somebody else rather than accepting responsibility. And in some ways, that's what Forbes was doing. You know, he blamed outsiders. He blamed a record rise in knife sales, and the FBI investigated that, and that turned out to be nonsense, too. Blamed the school board for not drawing up a good enough school desegregation plan and then dumping this all on his shoulders, which, you know, to some extent, there's something to be said for that. But Forbes looked to blame everybody else apart from himself and wanted to portray himself as being boxed into a corner and having no alternatives. He liked that story because that meant that what he did offered no alternatives. He had no option but to do that, and that was his only course of action.
The rain is shining down, birds all walking around, side to side, with no fear of fleeing to the sky.
Constantly I face this question as people talk to me. Are you going to uphold your oath to support the Constitution of the state of Arkansas and the Constitution of the United States, or are you going to enforce an illegal court order? And they firmly believe it was illegal, and there are many constitutional lawyers who think so today.
Everybody's gone, everybody's at home. Play. Fear lurks in the distance, it's just a breath away.
He made an argument that Arkansas was a moderate state and that they had kind of chosen Central High as a
test case.
Yeah, test case. That's right.
Mm. And that's another myth. You know, some of the other myths that revolve around the school crisis are that the Little Rock Nine were chosen by the NAACP and handpicked from the north and imported in, which is complete nonsense. Of course, the Little Rock Nine families all came from Little Rock, and many of them had long histories in the city. There are outside agitators coming in, all those kinds of things. I mean, all those were pretty standard for segregationists trying to deflect attention away from themselves at the time. Again, trying to blame everybody else apart from themselves for what happened.
From the corner of my eye, your car goes by, riding lonely down the street. And I see trees a-blowing, the earth is still beneath my feet.
I firmly believe that if the school board in Little Rock and Superintendent Blossom had not become imbued with delusions of grandeur and were becoming instant celebrities, and they had issued a public statement and said it and made it firm, said this doesn't concern anyone else. This is just our problem at Central High School. This is not going to affect your schools in Deschê County or Chico County or Arkansas County or your schools anywhere else. This is our local problem. We're going to handle it the best we can. I firmly believe there would never have been a Central High School crisis.
He said it got so emotional that, and particularly with the other side, that there was absolutely no middle ground, suggesting that he wanted to create a middle ground. Is that not true?
Well, no. I mean, you know, he does everything he can to polarize the situation in many ways and to grab out that middle ground. He calls out the National Guard, of course, which creates tension in the city. And then after many backwards and forwards with their president, he pulls out the National Guard, but then leaves the city altogether. So he creates this furore and then leaves and pulls out the National Guard and leaves it all to the local police force to deal with this mob that he's created. So he, you know, he creates this and then he just leaves and leaves the city to its own devices.
And he said he went to a governor's conference.
That's right. Yeah, he goes out of town to the annual Southern State Governor's Conference. What happens is that this gets turned over to the city police. I mean, ultimately, they're the ones charged with upholding law and order. And the chief of police at the time, Eugene Smith, does try his best and has his men out there and tries to protect the nine students. And they try and get the nine students into the school. The nine students actually do successfully get into the school. But the city police just can't deal with the size of the mob at Central High. And the mob gets so large and so unruly that they have to remove the nine students for their own safety in the end. So it's effectively, there is no capacity in the city to deal with this. Forbes has called out the National Guard. He's created this situation. Then he leaves. And then the city just does not have the capacity to deal with it, which is why Mayor Woodrow Mann ultimately calls on President Eisenhower to send in the federal troops. I mean, they ask for the federal troops to come in because there is nobody in the city who can now deal with this. There's an absence of leadership. The city doesn't have the capacity to control what's going on. So they need federal troops to come in to take charge of the situation because nobody is taking charge of the situation.
For almost 100 years, the courts had ruled that separate but equal was constitutional. The courts overturned all these precedents. As one judge in Florida argued, if a precedent is given no weight, then the law could change every time a court met. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's supposed to change based on the laws passed by Congress or amendment to the Constitution. Excuse me.
So Forbes made a calculated political choice, and he knew that he had to take a stand in order to be re-elected, and he made a successful career on the back of it. He was elected six consecutive times to office in an unprecedented kind of way, more than any other governor had been at the time, and he made a lot of political capital out of it. And the school crisis in many ways kind of tipped Forbes from being this moderate and on the fence and people not really knowing where he was, that threw him right into the maelstrom of it and made him a regional figure, made him a national figure. You know, people were talking about him running for the presidency. And, you know, in some ways he kind of fell into this and lapped it up and started playing up to his caricature more and more and donning this mantle of a segregationist because he realized that it was a successful career opportunity and a successful career move for him.
He said, "I would be classified as a moderate."
In his mind he is. In his mind he is. And, you know, he would say this, "All this other stuff is something that I had to do to get the other things that I needed to do get done." And that was, to him, an acceptable compromise. But of course, if you're a white politician and you're not immediately suffering on a day-to-day basis, as African-Americans are through the result of those policies, then it seems much less urgent to you.
So you did get your car fixed?
I did get my car fixed and I finally got home. Yeah.
Thanks. Thanks, but, John.
Thanks, Brad.
You, of course, as all the others do, will listen to many, many people, and you listen to all of them, and finally you will perhaps attain what LBJ calls that consensus. After getting the views of as many people as possible and learning the facts about a situation, you will try to make your decision based on what is the greatest good to the greatest number.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to singers and songwriters, Aaron Cam and the One Drops, Max Gomez, L. Wayne Ashley,
I'm gonna claim,
and Tim Anthony.
Rain is shining down, birds all walking around.
Thank you to Barry McCorkindale for the historical audio clips. A special thank you to Michael Hiblin. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt and William Wagner for the story editing advice. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the program. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to historian John Kirk for providing the raw taped interviews of Governor Faubus and for so eloquently helping us to understand and put into perspective civil rights in Arkansas. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Daisy Bates.
The man who never makes a mistake always takes orders from the one who does.